Welcome.
Can we advertise?
When you want to tell her when you're drinking, enjoying the Sprite as your fresh beverage?
It's sparkling and refreshing.
There was not a lot of product placement in Jaws, was there?
No, this was before that.
It kind of was. It was right before all the marketing. Right before Star Wars and all the big deal, 1975.
What was marketed in Star Wars?
Everything was marketed and turned into merchandise, I guess. I guess that's the other angle.
That was the opposite.
Yeah, that's true. Well, not the opposite, but it's just another angle on it.
I mean, not in the movie per se, after the movie.
Indeed. Okay, so welcome to the Futile Podcast. Tonight it's Mark and Ian. Hi, I'm Ian.
Johnny's out getting bitches.
Johnny's out going to the clubs. You can find him at the clubs if you are in Arcata tonight, which will not be the night this is posted. And we are going to talk about the classic 1975 film directed by Steven Spielberg. Not his first, but probably the one that really got him his name
on
the map.
This would be his third?
What was he? It was The Duel.
The Duel. And Sugarland Express.
And then, like, well, there was... When was Amblin made?
Oh, shit.
That was around Sugarland Express. So this might have been his fourth or fifth.
Might have been fourth.
Because he made Color Purple before this?
No, Color Purple was in the 80s.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I'm totally off. This was before Close Encounters. Close Encounters, the third kind, was 78.
77? No.
It was before this, though.
That's kind of crazy, because I remember some sort of deal worked out between him and Lucas, because I thought there was some sort of conflict. They didn't want a Star Wars movie and Close Encounters to come out the same year.
Okay, yeah, well, they met, yeah, so it was like 76 and 77, or 78 and 77.
Yeah, maybe 77
or
and 78.
Anywho, that's all kind of moot stuff. Basically, this is based on the Peter Benchley novel, which is really just a, I don't know, I haven't read the book. Do you have any experience with the book? Is it just sort of a straightforward kind of, who cares?
The book's pretty dry.
Yeah.
And the book...
You made it sound like it's more of a soap opera, right?
Right, there's a lot of drama in the book. For instance, the character Hooper, played by Richard Dreyfuss, has an affair with Chief Brody's wife, and and Chief Brody finds out about it.
Of course.
And the ending in the book was a lot lamer. It was literally more of a Moby Dick. Captain Ahab, he's in this little dinghy and ends up drowning because of the shark, and I think harpooning it. It was literally Moby Dick.
And then this was the sheriff, Brody, dies at the end
Quint.
Oh, Quint. What happened to Brody at the end of the book?
I think he survives.
Okay, sounds all pretty unremarkable. And as we know, Bentley has gone on to do other things about giant squids, and he kind of just decided to continue.
Well, he did The Deep. That's another one. Man, we need to watch next time, if you're feeling up to it. We should do The Deep. It's Lou Gosse and Robert Shaw and Nick Nolte in tits.
And Jacqueline Bisset, yeah.
Tits.
Yeah, okay.
It was good. Okay. It's good tits.
Can't go wrong.
Hey, any young man at that age would is probably... having fun memories of childhood, you know, thinking about that was a big deal, you know?
Heck yeah.
Okay. And she was getting a little bit older by that point. She was like one of the first, well, actually, you already had The Graduate and the Mrs. Robinson thing, but she was definitely one of the first so-called MILFs.
Okay, then.
I don't know if she had children, though.
She'd be like a illyof. An illif.
An illif?
Like an old lady I'd like to fuck.
Well, I mean, she must have been in her 30s. But she looks considerably older. Looks a lot more mature than she did.
In Bullet.
In Bullet. She was looking young. Okay. In Bullet.
Jacqueline Bisset is not in this. There's no soap opera There's no soap opera bullshit in this movie. This movie is very cut to the chase. It moves a lot faster. I think the last time I honestly saw this movie, I was in some kind of shark kick as a kid. As I'm sure all kids are, with big monster-y real things that scare them, you know, dinosaurs and sharks and all that sort of stuff.
Big scary things with teeth.
Yeah, exactly. Well, they're like the real monsters. You know what I mean? It's like the difference. Absolutely. You know, I mean, obviously dinosaurs are extinct, but
there are real monsters.
As a kid, yeah, exactly. As a kid, exactly. And then we brought up that whole aspect.
And we get the World War II story again.
Uh huh. Yes, another World War II story from Robert Shaw. But no, this movie is much faster than I remember. I remember being much very slow as a kid, but at the same time, like, the ending was always, to me, like, it's just the epitome of what you get in a nightmare. Just, like, everything, the boat starts to sink.
Everything's going wrong.
And everything goes wrong, and there's no spot, there's no place to hide, there's no bit of place to take refuge. You just, it's sink or swim, literally, and
you're out in the middle of the Atlantic. Yeah. Well, you're not quite out in the middle of it, but you're on this little tiny ass boat surrounded by a huge fucking shark that seems to have an attitude and wants to kill you, and you're being led by a crazy man. Things really kind of hit the fan at that point.
Crazy with vengeance and old age and I don't know what. It was crazy with just his attitude about things and what he'd gone through in his life.
He had suffered some trauma, and I think he self-medicated.
Mm, yes. With the apricot brandy.
With the apricot brandy?
That was one of his demands.
He made his own own stuff.
Yeah,
his
don't stuff. Don't drink that. Don't drink that. No, it's honestly, now people have said, and I'm not sure, I don't really know enough about this anyway, and I can't judge, Spielberg is not much of an actor's director. You know, like, he comes from more of a visual approach, and he's got a definite, like, there's definitely, like, you know, a sense of an auteur in Spielberg. You've seen shots. I mean, in Jaws, it's early on, and you're getting the whole use of that, the dolly zoom where it compresses space and everything, and that's all really cool stuff. But the thing that surprised me the most about this movie is the performances, and is just the sort of way that, like, the behavior and the acting is. I mean, I don't know if that's to Spielberg's credit or because maybe as a young director he did do more with that before he got into these bigger, more epic adventure stories where that wasn't so much of an issue, or if it's just the quality of the actors that he had. I mean, you know, all the Indiana Jones movies, you get a lot of the same stuff because it's Ford, and so Ford brings that to the character, I think. You know, those nuances of his behavior and those sort of little, like, ways. But Roy Scheider has got it all over the place in this movie. Just things that he's doing, especially when he's on the boat, that are just so authentic to a guy who's afraid of water, afraid that he's on this boat, afraid of the shark. He doesn't know anything about, like, being on a boat. He's just this character that's had authority in his life because he's been, a police officer, and he's, like, a sheriff. But now he's in a situation where he's literally figuratively and ironically sort of a fish out of water. You know, get it? Because he's on a boat and he doesn't know how to be on a boat.
I'm smiling, folks.
Yes, he is.
Ear to ear.
But just, like, the authenticity of the characters and the rationales for the behavior. And, like, in a story like this where the chief antagonist is not a person, so it can't really have, like, any... It's motivation. It's a shark, you know? It does its thing. It's tough to make that, like, a solid conflict. But they bring the mayor in as this sort of effective sort of antagonist for the first part of the movie.
But he's not a bad guy.
No, but that's just it. Exactly. It totally makes sense. It's totally justifiable. And you get his side of it and everything else. He's just like, I don't, you know, this is how everyone survives here on this island, is by this the income of these people coming in and swimming and having a good time. And if we shut this down, then, you know, everyone's going to...
His kids were on the beach, too.
Exactly. His kids were on the beach, too. And so you have that element. Everything's... All the behaviors of the characters are believable. And that's critical.
I thought the mayor... For some reason, the mayor always really struck me. And I really... Pretty much everybody's performance. Like you were saying, there's just something about this movie where... I mean, especially, it's just incredible considering all the problems with the production and... they're just incredible performances, and it's enjoyable to watch. I mean, it's one of those movies that, I mean, it's how old now? It's got to be 34 years old. And to me, it's a timeless movie.
No, it's definitely, I mean, and we know that because the story has been not necessarily perverted, but cribbed on by so many of those.
I'm sticking to Dante's Peak. I'm like, it's the same fucking movie. The shark's just a volcano.
Yeah, yeah. And all the Sci-Fi Channel original movies where it's the rural sheriff.
Oh, Jesus.
And it's the... I mean, yeah, but that's the funny part about it.
Like Dr. Giggles?
Yeah.
That was a Sci-Fi original.
I don't know if Dr. No, that was a Manny...
But it had the old sheriff.
Manny Coto original. But no, it's about the sheriff. There's some creature... And it's eating people, it's terrorizing. There's the sheriff that starts figuring it out. Then there's, like, the mayor that's like, what are you talking about, sheriff? Then there's the posse angle. And then where they all go out and after it. I mean, it's like a Silver Bullet. The horror movie, Stephen King movie.
You know, I never actually saw that. I heard it was pretty bad.
It's the same kind of thing, though. You know, it's all right as a horror movie. It's just a werewolf movie. There's nothing. It's got Gary Busey in it. And a kid in a wheelchair. And he sets fireworks off. And the whole angle of the kid being in the wheelchair, like, it makes him, like, that much... Like, he can't run away, he has to wheel away.
Oh, but that would have been... I mean, they'd already done that. You had Texas Chainsaw Massacre, the fat kid in the wheelchair.
Yeah, but then he just gets fed to the slaughter. He's not the main kid.
But it's even better in Texas Chainsaw Massacre 2, because Dennis Hopper comes across the skeleton in a wheelchair and then breaks down for a second. But then, of course, you have Friday the 13th, part 2, I believe. Yeah, it's part 2.
Yeah, where he pushes the guy in the wheelchair. But the whole thing about that, okay, is that it was the main character, and that was the arc
so
was around.
So we're going to stop talking about wheelchairs and Silver Bullet?
Yeah, we can stop talking about that now. And that whole angle.
I don't consider this a horror movie at all.
Well, it's not necessarily, but it's certainly got those elements of a horror movie.
I thought that was odd when I was a kid. Going in the video store because Jaws was always in the horror section. I always thought that was odd.
It's a more sophisticated suspense horror film. I mean, because it's a monster.
It has actually developed characters.
Yeah, well, no, but it's aside from the fact that it's a quote good movie and that it is because of the things we're talking about with the performances, the authenticity, the sense that you feel like it's a fully functional, real place where things are happening. It's not fake. It's not the motivations for all the people make sense. Everything kind of falls into position, which is elements of a good story is that you have the characters and why they do what they do. Is never leaving you scratching your head. Even when Quinn at the end smashes the radio, you're like, not only you can't just say, "Oh, he's a crazy old fuck." It's like, no, he didn't do that out of being crazy. He did that out of being pissed. He's like, "No, I'm going to kill this shark. I'm not going to let you call in the big wigs with 5 Coast Guard ships, and then they'll take that out." It's like, and he has personal to him.
But it's also money too. Because somebody else gets the shark, he ain't getting his $10,000.
Well, he's getting something, probably. And his boat's already fucked at that point anyway.
Well, he's getting $200 a day, whether they catch him or not.
Yeah.
And his case of brandy and
and
the zoning issues taken care of.
But the point is, like, all that stuff is there. But no, I mean, it's a real monster movie, which is, you know, there's something... from without attacking people and killing them and all that. So that in that sense, it has the elements to a horror movie. But like you said, it's elevated because of these other things, because of the quality of the production and the work they put into it and everything.
Even the animatronic shark I didn't think was terrible. I mean, you could tell it was fake. But they cut in only when the shark was actually out of the water. Was it really obvious that the shark was fake? And, you know, we're talking about that a little bit about, what did you bring up? Deep Blue Sea or some
bullshit.
Yeah,
Deeper Blue or My Hand is Like a Shark's Fin.
And everything would be done CGI. I mean, pretty much everything. If he has somebody cool like Stan Winston involved in it or some...
Well, he's dead now, so you can't.
He is?
Yeah, Stan Winston, RIP.
When did he die?
It's like 6 months ago.
Oh, shit. Wow. That's too bad. Mm-hmm. And, but anyway, well, then fucking rule that out. Anyway, I mean, they cut in enough footage of actual sharks and...
No, it all works. And even...
And that crazy thing with the shark in the,
mashing up the tank, the,
That was real. That was a real shark and it was an accident. They're trying to film the shark going around this cage and shit. And they were filming in Australia. It was, crocodile hunter type guy in the crew down there, and they have this shark, and they actually had a man in this, trying to remember how they did it, I think it was actually the man was in the tank, or in the cage, in the water with these sharks. And the shark, they were throwing out chum, or they had something that was enticing the sharks, and they got all pissy with each other, and they're fighting. And the shark gets caught in the, I guess it would have been the cable or the chain holding the thing, and just starts beating the shit out of this this cage. And I can't remember if the guy was in it or not.
Maybe in the footage, there's no one in it.
Right, so the guy must not have been in it. Oh, Jesus. But, yeah, I just remember watching an interview of the guy talk about it and just being blown away by
this footage. There was a documentary in the 70s or something, and that might be where they took the footage from sharks.
It was specifically for the movie.
Okay, well, but, yeah. So, no, I actually don't have a real problem with the animatronic stuff, even, you know, when it's eating Quinn and all that. I mean, if a shark did get that far out, it probably would kind of look like that. You know, it would look kind of stupid because it's supposed to be underwater. You're not used to seeing something like that above water.
Well, the one thing that I did notice when you're seeing the actual footage of real sharks is the real sharks, it did look a little bit different.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a lot, you know, it's a great white shark, and you notice that the bottom of it is just really, really white. And, of course, the fluid, the motions is so much more fluid.
Oh, yeah, of course.
But they are, man, they are wicked-looking motherfuckers.
Yeah, they're designed, they're a perfect machine or whatever you're
right.
saying.
It, what was it, a miracle of evolution or something like that. It swims, it eats, it makes little sharks, and that's all it does.
All it ever needs to do, yeah. I mean, this is such an old movie, like you said, 34 years. If you haven't seen this movie, don't write it off. Even if you're like the person that's like, oh, I hate monster movies, or I hate horror movies, or I hate suspense movies, or I'm not interested in anything. It's a good movie. I mean, I always feel like I have to make myself watch it, but I actually enjoy it. So it's one of those like that for me. I don't know why it is. I've had it for years and just haven't felt like watching it.
I know what you mean. I have movies like that that I absolutely love, but watching them, I don't know, there's so many emotions and memories connected to some of them, that's just all part of it, and sometimes I don't, it's almost kind of sad for me to watch them again.
Yeah, I get you, yeah.
As opposed to not you have having like that moment when you were a kid, when you first saw the movie.
Yeah, it's the nostalgia. No,
especially if you're by yourself.
Definitely. No, for this, it's just solid. I mean,
it is a solid movie.
But the thing I was the most impressed with, because I probably haven't seen this movie in like 15, 20, maybe a long time since I was a kid. So probably at least 15 years since I saw it proper and all the way through. I just didn't remember that it was just, it's like Robert Altman movie or something. There's a lot of double talking, you know, where there's one person talking to another person and on top, like, the people talking over each other and crowd scenes.
It doesn't
seem
as scripted.
No, it seems very, like I said, it seems very authentic. And
all
the
people kind of mumble a little bit. And some of the times you can't even tell what the hell's Quinn's saying.
You can never tell what Quinn's saying. And it's just so well, the structure is for the most part very good. I mean, once they get on the boat,
it flows really well.
Once they get out on the boat almost has like a three act structure unto itself. You know, where like they first,
it is like a separate movie.
They have like their first encounter with the shark, and then they kind of have, you know, the little break, and then they kind of talk and they build character, and then they sing songs, and they kind of have a second encounter, and things, you know, get elevated, and the stakes get raised as the engine gets taken down and to a degree, and then they have the end, you know, where it's all climactic and shit happens and things are sinking. And so it really it's weird in that sense, because the first half of the movie, it isn't slow because it moves so quickly and it sort of is establishing itself and building itself up, but it's a very like oddly structured movie, I guess, because like you said, that whole part on the boat is like its own movie of, you know, that it's sort of tough to see like a first act and second act and call that the third for me. I don't even know. I guess the big point that pushes them into the third act is when the mayor admits, okay, yeah, there's a shark, after the 4th of July thing. And then
first act is leading up
to the second kill, I would say.
The second kill, the Kittner.
Yeah. And then once that's happened, it's kind of like, oh crap. And he knows it's a kid, and then
whole scene, I mean, it really, it is really kind of interesting, and it really changes the tone all of a sudden.
With the woman, with the mother?
And it was somewhat authentic, I thought. And it wasn't as overly dramatic as it could have been.
No, I mean, you know, it was sort of melodramatic, but it needed to be there in the
but
film.
But it's a mother who just lost her son.
Yeah, exactly, literally. Exactly. But it is sort of this way she sort of publicly humiliates Brody and everything sort of too, and all that. It's kind of theatrical, is what I'm saying. But it works. I mean, you don't sit there and roll your eyes and be like, this is so ham-fisted and cheesy. It's like, no, it works.
And, you know, like you said, I mean, Brody's really vested at that point also, because he's a father. And he can tell that he's taking it into his heart, the responsibility for the death of that child, because he did know better. But he didn't stand his ground, and he let the mayor and the city selectmen or whatever they were roll over the top of him.
And the ME. I mean, the ME is the biggest fault there. He's got to be. I mean, because he confirms. He's like, well, are you sure you told me earlier that it was a shark attack? And the ME seems almost like the most corrupt guy there, because he's like, no, we'll change the reports. We'll make...
I was wrong.
I was wrong. We'll change the reports. That's not the situation. So, I mean, that takes a lot off of Brody, because Brody could certainly be, I could have always been more paranoid and not trusted that the ME, who's the person I have to trust on these things, because I don't know...
Yeah, but he knows the ME is lying.
He's not...
Of pressure
He suspects, but at the same time, he's not an islander. They establish that he is this New York guy.
Right, he's a fish out of water.
Fish out of water again. And he doesn't know, he doesn't know. Well, I guess a
right,
boat could do that.
It establishes that they had moved there in the fall.
Yeah.
So, at the beginning of the movie.
And so now it's summer. It's July 4th
which
weekend.
Which is where they all make their money.
Mm-hmm.
And as opposed to Christmas time like everybody else.
Yeah. Well, no, because it's an island. It's a holiday vacation, summer vacation place. So it makes sense that it's a tourist trap like that. I mean, there's places all over California and all over everywhere where I think they make most of their... Probably make more of their money...
Oh, you mean before they get terminated?
Yeah, before they get terminated. I mean, yeah, it just works as a movie. And honestly, it's not as long as it feels, I don't think. I think you're probably right. It probably is close to the two-hour mark, because that whole boat thing is longer. But they get to that boat thing quicker, and they move everything along at about the right pace. It does... I don't know. I mean, it does kind of feel like... you get that, like, there's sort of some repetition in the first two acts, you know, where it's like, he's afraid, they should have closed the beach down, they're sitting there at the beach, kind of waiting, and he's waiting for something to happen, and then it does, and then hubbub.
He's tense, but nobody else.
And then the next one, that, I guess, is the difference, is everyone is kind of tense, and then they kind of relax, but then it happens again, and so it's kind of like...
What beach scene are you talking about?
Well, there are really two. There's the one where the Kittner kid...
Right, that's
killed.
The one I was thinking.
And then there's the second one, which is the 4th of July one.
Because everybody's tense at the...
Yeah, exactly.
Not everybody, but the people, the islanders,
know
there's a problem, and they're a little nervous.
Exactly.
But in the first one, there's such a... I mean, there's really an obvious contrast between his mood and everybody else's mood.
That's true. I mean, so it's not like a totally redundant, like, you're really waiting for, like they're not really repeating themselves. They keep the pace flowing just right. They keep
the
activity.
Well, the 4th of July was, you see, they had the Kittner boy and then they caught that shark.
Yeah.
And everybody wanted to believe that that was the shark.
Mm-hmm.
So you had the 4th of July to say, no, that wasn't the shark. There's still a problem.
Absolutely. I mean, no, I understand the motivations for everything, and it really does work really well.
And some of the special effects. I mean, it's like that leg. That leg almost gets me because it looks like a real fucking leg.
Yeah, I would say most of the members and arms and legs and stuff.
The arm with the girl, it's hard to say because it had been floating in the ocean.
And it was
older, so
it was all bloated and gross and everything. So yeah, it was like, that doesn't look like what that girl's arm would look like. And you're like, well, yeah, it would if it were floating in the ocean for 2 days.
And it had been stuck in a freezer for however long.
Exactly. So, I mean, I think we nitpicked this a bunch anyway.
I don't feel like I'm...
Well, no. I just mean, like, we're talking about really minute details to a degree. But we've also talked about the overriding whole thing and the fact that the reason... I mean, this is just what they forget about when they try to make movies that emulate this kind of movie. Is that
and first, this was the beginning. This was the summer blockbuster. It made a bazillion dollars.
Yeah, I mean, I think The Godfather and stuff was before that. I don't know if it was a summer blockbuster, but it made a lot of money. And it's all about story, you know? People want to see... They want to be able to see characters where it makes sense and that the motivation is there.
And all the characters get panned out enough that you have an appreciation for who they are.
Yeah, definitely.
And like you said, it really goes to their motivations, so it makes sense.
Yeah, you're never left... I mean, that takes me out of a movie worse than just about anything else... Is just when you start questioning an action of a character, you're like, why are they doing this? That doesn't make any sense.
It's like in horror movies where people always go back in the house.
Or run up the stairs again and shit like that.
You know, the one thing I will give for those kind of horror movies is in real life, you're not going to expect that there's some kind of monster. Mm-hmm. It's ridiculous when you know there's a killer in the house and you go back in anyway. It's kind of like... what's a good example? Like somebody running back into their house that's on fire to grab their photographs or some shit.
Yeah.
But, yeah, it just really all made sense to me.
No, and that's the key to making a good movie is that get your characters figured out, get it all to make sense, and then, you know, you need a conflict, you need an antagonist, and you've got the shark as your antagonist.
There were some great conflicts, though, and another one that I really enjoyed...
Robert Shaw and
Richard Dreyfuss and the working man Nero crowd.
Uh-huh. And it sounds like there was a little bit of that behind the scenes too.
Mr. Hooper, you've been counting money all your life.
Yeah.
I love that. There are some great lines. There are just so many famous ones, of course, the most famous. And that was what's kind of crazy about that is that was ad-libbed by Roy Scheider.
Which one?
We need a bigger boat.
Oh, yeah, of course.
And, yeah.
And he keeps saying it. And that's what's so great about that character and so real is that, like...
Oh, right.
When you're with...
get a bigger boat.
Yeah, when you're with somebody... I've seen documentary footage of, like a camera guy, like a news guy with, like, a bunch of firefighters that are in, like, a wildland fire... And he's like, you know, he's doing that. He's the guy out of water, doesn't know what's going on. He's kind of like, so we need to kind of get out of here, right? Like, so we need to leave, maybe, don't you think? And then they're just like, shut up, okay? We're paying attention. We know what we're doing. And Roy Scheider's just like that. He's like, we should go and we get a bigger boat and we'll come back with a bigger boat, maybe, right? We don't need to be here right now. He's clearly afraid and trying to come up with like a, well, here's the excuse. We just need a bigger boat. That's all. And if we go get a bigger boat, then we'll come back and... And like all that stuff works, and then the way that like Roy Scheider like hurts Richard Dreyfuss with the rope because he's not paying attention because he's panicked and because he doesn't know how to do stuff.
Man, that gets me every time. That would hurt.
Oh no,
bad.
Yeah, that's great.
Across the back of the legs like that.
Oh no, it's fabulous. All those little things, those little foibles, those little you know when you don't pay attention, when you don't keep things ship shape, you get hurt, and. And I love seeing that sort of stuff in a movie where it's treated seriously. Because it's very slapstick, but it's not funny.
Is language. I was just thinking about that. Just how much... I mean, you're dealing with some... You know, you're dealing with a bunch of guys, some fairly salty folks. But I mean, I guess it would depend on the kind of movie. Movies are just made so strangely these days. I mean, that is the beauty of the indie film, but... You could never. The problem is, you could never make a Jaws as an indie film, really.
Well, you could, but the point.
Boat and I mean that costs some money.
You would cheat some stuff, and yeah, you could try it. I don't know. I mean, it depends
and
on
the cast.
It depends on your definition of indie. I mean, if your definition of indie is like $15 million, you could probably do something comparable to a Jaws, and it would be crappy CG, like you said, which is not super expensive. and then you would have a low-end cast. You'd have a couple of TV CG guys and stuff.
I'd rather see a couple of models floating along.
Yeah, exactly.
The bathtub.
And it would probably, I mean, if they were going to remake Jaws or something, it would definitely be PG-13.
They're never going to remake Jaws.
Yeah, I don't think anyone's going to touch any of Spielberg's work, at least as long as he's alive and as long as he's, like, head of a major studio.
How could that even happen?
Because they run out of ideas, and
that would be so fucking ridiculous.
The youth generation is like, you know, I don't know, I don't want to watch that movie. It doesn't have Ashton Kutcher in it. It doesn't have, like, Megan Fox in it. There's no hot chicks. There's no hot chicks in Jaws.
Was Megan Fox the Transformers?
Yeah, too? Yeah.
I haven't seen it.
It doesn't.
I keep hearing people talk about her, though. I'm like, who the fuck is Megan Fox?
Doesn't matter. The point is, these are the selling points for things these days. And then you gotta sell the toys, and you gotta make it PG-13, so you dumb down the violence, you take out the cursing, and...
Oh, well, anyway, that was just something that
I... You would have killed the mayor in a newer version of it, too. You would have made the mayor more ridiculous and evil, and you would have killed the mayor.
Oh, and he would have gotten...
I mean, think about what the body count in the first Jaws is low. I mean, you got the woman at the beginning, you got the kid, you got the other guy, and then you got Quint. You got four people that die from... Oh, no, you got that guy that you never see, but you see his body later, the right. Fisherman. So you get five people, maybe? You know, that one guy doesn't... Then he makes it. The guy with his that's using his wife's Christmas ham or whatever.
Right, he made it.
He
made it. The dude that lost his leg did not.
No, and so... Really, it's not like a super. The body count's just not high. You would have a higher body count, but you'd have less consequences of that violence, you know. Or you would go hard R with it and make it super gratuitous and insanely, like, arms flailing everywhere and blood gushing at forth and all kinds of stuff. It's a moot point to talk about something like that, because, like I said, with those Sci-Fi Channel movies and stuff, there's almost no reason that those are constantly trying to remake.
Like Carnosaurus.
Yeah, like Carnosaur and shit. Those are just constant bullshit, low-end, low-brow remakes of something like this. You know, take a sheriff, take an evil corporate developer or whoever is going to be the stand-in for profit and money and business and commerce, and then take a monster and throw them all together and have them all fight each other, and there you go. But this movie does it well. I mean, I think it's
great that certain things will never go away.
I mean, we'll always appreciate it in our generation, and I honestly couldn't tell you what the generation after us thinks about it, you know? Like, I couldn't tell you what, like, a 16-year-old kid thinks about this movie, or if they are even aware of it.
There's gotta be, because, I mean, where do you think I developed my appreciation for Steve McQueen movies, or old westerns, or war movies?
You know, you had that
or
kind
even
of...
my mom, with Arsenic and Old Lace.
You had that relationship with your family, and, with your grandfather,
or,
with your dad.
Or, something like The Ghost of Mrs. Muir. I mean, how else would I get introduced to something like that?
You got introduced to it because that culture was around. The culture where you would watch movies with your family or something. Now it's all people watching stuff on the internet on their own. They're insular. They got their TV in their room. I mean, it's perfectly believable that the newest generation
is kind of weird because
not
everybody
share. There's no generational transfer between between things like that necessarily. You have to actually be active about it. You have to either have, like, an older brother or some, like, you know, want to emulate some hipster guy that tells you that these movies are awesome. In order to do that, like, I can tell you that when I was taking a science and science fiction class down in Riverside years ago, this would have been my generation, a bunch of students about my age, maybe a year younger, maybe a year older. They asked the whole group of 30 of us, like, how many of you have seen the film 2001: A Space Odyssey? And I think I was the only one that raised my hand.
That's really that weird because I saw it at least twice just in high school.
Yeah, I mean, they might have shown it in high. I don't know what
I had it in Mr. Edwards' class, and I had it in my summer school English class.
Crazy.
When I was a freshman going into sophomore.
Well, I mean, so there's that situation, and these students just didn't have that. They had some different movie that was shown to them or something. I don't know, All Quiet on the Western Front or who knows what. Like, it would make sense.
Saw that one, too.
Mm-hmm. But, no, I mean...
And then, of course, you were such a Stanley Kubrick fan that, of course, I probably watched it with you also.
I don't know if I ever put anybody else through that movie. I really liked it. That's one other on my own one. That's one of the few I own on Blu-ray at this point. I think it's
probably just as well because I...
Most people really... It is really... honestly, I have no problem just admitting to people it is very boring.
There are parts that are entertaining. Hal is always entertaining. It's a movie that I'd only want to watch so many times because it makes you think too fucking hard.
Yeah, that's exactly it. And it's just so rich visually that you just have to watch it in the right mood.
You know, it's interesting you were talking about types of directors and Spielberg not being an actor's director. And I was thinking most actor's directors that I've listened to describe themselves as that or actors describing the director. It's because they are fucking actors.
A lot of times. I would say that it's tough. I mean, some actors that direct stuff, I don't say necessarily always get the best performances out of other actors. Maybe because they're acting as well.
Well, you know, what is it? If you cast a movie right, I mean, half the battle's already won.
Yeah, but that has to do with being able to use... I mean, that means you knew how to use them and everything else. No, no.
But then there's so much involved. I mean, the story... The actors can only do so much with a shit story.
Absolutely. Or
shit writing. I mean, the perfect example that just pops in my head is Righteous Kill.
Oh, of course.
It was such a shitty fucking story. You got Bobby De Niro and you got Al Pacino. Uh-huh. What the fuck?
You throw in Brian Dennehy for good measure.
And Brian Dennehy for good measure, just in case the two barrels don't get you, the third one.
And you got Johnny the Legs Leguizamo.
Oh, shit.
Yeah. And Donnie saw to Wahlberg.
Oh, Wahlberg.
And,
what did I see him in? It really took me by surprise. It was one of the first things.
He's in a lot of different weird stuff. That's true. But no, you're right. Early. But that also can come down to directing too. You're right. It starts with story, then it comes to how the director and the actors work that story out. And usually that's the difference. I think you end up with more mediocre movies if there's bad directing with good actors and a reasonable story. Like, if you look at it, you're like, oh, it all kind of worked. Something like The Score. Marlon Brando, Edward Norton, and...
I didn't think it was terrible.
It's mediocre, right?
Yeah,
and that's
it's
probably...
It's watchable.
It's Frank Oz just, not being that great of a director, really. I mean, he's done some reasonable stuff, but I also have heard that, you know, of course, him and Brando just didn't get along with shit, so that's a whole... And there were script problems to a degree, but for the most part, the script is kind of bland, but it works. So, you know, there you go. I think this movie, like you said, Jaws just is one of those kind of charmed movies, to use a term, that where the
Spielberg
story is good.
Just had that.
Yeah.
Early in his career. I mean, it was just one charmed situation after another.
I would honestly...
Raiders had that magic to me.
Oh, sure. But that was very well crafted, very referential of the stuff they were doing. And there were a lot of iterations they were going on with, as we've talked before in other podcasts. But here's the thing. For me, Close Encounters of a Third Kind is a
very... was a big...
No, it's big just... Fan. It seems to me like it's all about, like, the last 20 minutes. And up till then, it's very boring. It's like Richard Dreyfuss building a mountain out of mashed potatoes and just kind of, like, looking around and being quiet. And I like some of that, and I may enjoy the film more if I watch it now, because I haven't seen that movie in probably about 20 years. But,
I haven't seen that movie since I was a kid.
Exactly. And it's like... I don't know. I just... So, I wouldn't say that every single Spielberg movie is a hit. One of my favorites is something like,
You know, The Duel was one of my favorite movies when I was a kid.
Yeah.
But when I was a little kid, I probably got introduced to Jaws when I was 6 or 7 years old. I was young. And it was my favorite movie for a long time, and I always wanted to watch it. Which seems kind of odd to me. But, you know, there's the monsters aspect, but... Something about that movie just grabbed me from a really early age, and it was just my favorite movie for a long time.
Probably
until I became a teenager.
I enjoyed the Jaws movies, like the series, because there's like a second one, a third one, and I know they're all pretty crappy.
The second one, at least,
is still Roy Scheider and all
Roy
that.
Roy Scheider. Yeah. It has the majority of the characters coming back, except for Richard Dreyfuss and, of course, Quinn.
Yeah, Quinn. No.
No.
That's what I said.
And that's great, too.
Yeah, exactly. Just no. It's about men, you know, in that last act.
And Roy Scheider, he had been on a roll too. He had had the French Connection. Mm-hmm. He had the, oh shit, All That Jazz.
I don't know. But Roy Scheider, you're right. He had been on a roll. He had done a bunch of stuff. And then he came back around and did Sequest.
Well, I think he had some, was it alcohol problem or?
I don't know. Would that have been in the 80s after all of this?
Yeah.
It's possible. I don't know. I don't.
Well, I mean, yeah.
Maybe he just had kids and had enough money and didn't care for a while. Who knows?
No, I think he had some problems, but I was going to say, Blue Thunder, I think, was his last movie for a while, wasn't it?
I don't know. We could look at IMDb later or something, but it's not that interesting. All I know is that, like, he showed up in time to be the Captain Nathan Bridger on Sequest DSP.
Well, you know how he got awesome. The part. He ran into, I can't remember if it was Spielberg. Somebody, a producer or somebody, he bumped into, maybe it was Spielberg, and just asked him what they were working on at some party in New York. And started talking about this Jaws movie, and actually the title Jaws, I think it took him a while to come up with that. But yeah, it's just really interesting, and he wanted to be a part of it. And the whole thing with Richard Dreyfuss, I think he wasn't going to do it either. And the movie he had just done, like, totally flopped, and at the last minute he signed on just in case he, you know, had just killed his career with that other movie. Yeah. So, which, of course, didn't turn out to be the case.
No, it didn't. Though that is weird, because the kind of character he plays in Jaws, I wouldn't say is something that he has done much since. I mean, because Richard Dreyfuss, he did other things. Roy Scheider was always kind of a sort of tough guy, quiet cop type. So in that sense, he kind of fit the cast.
Robert Shaw tended to play a nut.
Yeah, a nut, kind of gnarly.
Well, not grizzled. Say colorful.
Yeah, grizzled and colorful. Yeah.
Well, not in From Russia with Love.
Yeah, that's true. That was the missing link there.
that is bizarre.
Definitely. But,
He died not long. Oh, no. He died after The Deep in 78 or 79.
Poor Robert Shaw.
It's a shame. I mean, his performances are.
Yep, taking of Pelham 1-2-3.
No,
you didn't see that.
I got Force 10 and Navarone. No, I don't. It's on VHS.
But Taking of Pelham 1-2-3 is good.
I had The Sting. We should do The Sting sometime.
Yeah, I watched it a while ago. I think you let me borrow it. Yeah, okay. I could do it. Zach and I talked about it real quickly, but yeah, there was not. I don't know.
It's one of those great movies if you had never seen it before. I guess it wouldn't. It'd be one of those movies that would be great to show your kids or something. Because I remember the first time I watched it with my dad. The ending hasn't been spoiled for you.
Yeah, that's true. I think I have to give Josh 4.5 out of 5.
I'm going to give it 5.
There we go. We both give it very solid, high reviews. And that's obvious, obviously. I don't know. You could be the kind of person that wants to be like anti-everybody and everything and find
Citizen
ways.
Citizen Kane's the only movie that gets 5 stars kind of thing.
No, I just mean, like, I'm sure there are people out there that can find way, that don't like Jaws and that can find excuses for why they don't, but I don't know. I mean, that, you know, there's always that weird angle where you feel like kind of an idiot talking about something that everyone knows is so good and saying why you think it's so good and then giving it a good rating. And it's like, okay, that's pretty moot. We all get that it's good. Like, it's almost like objectively good.
I think a lot
good.
Of people know of Jaws. I mean, yeah. How could you not? But I bet you a lot of people have never actually seen it.
Yeah, and this newer generation. Anyway, we recommend it to you if you're a listener of a podcast and you're young, which you probably would be. To go out and see it based on our kind of strange yammering discussion on it, which doesn't really cover the plot because either everyone knows the plot or, like we said, we kind of loosely covered the plot. And I think we're somewhat spoiler-free, but maybe
need Zach here to lay out the plot for us.
Yeah, exactly. Just hammer it out real quick. I usually prefer not to bother with the plot in a lot of reviews of things. I feel like
how can you not figure out what the fucking plot is of Jaws? It's pretty straightforward.
Well, if you hadn't seen the movie before, and just
there's like, a shark. It's eating people. And, they go to try to kill it.
And then they stop it. Yes. Do they stop it, though? Who knows? You'll have to watch the movie.
Well, if you believe Jaws 2, Jaws 3, and Jaws 4.
And Jaws 4, The Revenge.
Jaws 4, The Revenge.
Jaws 3D.
With Michael Caine.
And Mario Van Peebles.
Mario Van Peebles.
And the mother and Roy Scheider's son.
Yeah, Lorraine Gary, I think her name is.
No, sharks never come down to Florida. The weather's too warm. Da-da-da. They do if it's the mom of the son from the first Jaws.
What the hell? Sharks? They like warm water.
Well, not great whites.
Oh, great whites.
That's why they like Humboldt County, where we live. Because it's cold water off the coast right there. It's not tropical water, you know?
That's true. And, well, there are lots of... lots of different kinds of sharks.
Yeah, exactly. But we're dealing with Jaws, we're dealing with great whites. We're dealing with the lineage.
You ever seen a frontal shot of a hammerhead shark coming at you? And you can see underneath it, and there's just all these gnarly-ass teeth.
Mm-hmm.
It's freaky looking.
Scary stuff.
Yeah, I don't remember what that whole appendage on their head is for. Or... grow whatever it is.
I got no idea. I'm sure it's an easy enough thing to figure out.
It's probably some sort of sonar thing.
Check it on the wiki. Okay, as usual, if you want to download further podcasts, you can find us at graniteseed.com/futilepodcast. You can search for us on iTunes under Futile Podcast.
Oh, and be sure if you buy Jaws, if you buy the DVD and not the Blu-ray.
You should probably buy the Blu-ray
if you're gonna buy the Blu-ray, but make sure it's got the DTS.
Well, the Blu-ray will have all kinds of nifty audio functions, I'm assuming. I don't know if it's out on Blu-ray yet, though. They may do a Spielberg collection. Heat isn't out on Blu-ray yet.
Oh, really?
Yeah, no, I know. I everything that I wanted to rebuy, I pretty much
did. That'd be the third time. I'm just skipping Blu-ray. I'm just waiting until whatever comes
next. It's not going to be a disc thing. It's going to be all internet streaming... crap. It's going to be all digital.
Bullshit.
No, it's not going to be another disc thing. It probably not. And you know, if you're going to skip Blu-ray, then you're probably going to wait 10 years.
So what you're telling me is you can't have a hard copy of the movie you buy? That's ridiculous.
It might get that way. You might be able to get a
burned copy. Do you realize how precarious that would be?
Because yeah.
Anybody that's ever had a fucking... It's like, how many times do you have to... That's so ridiculous.
I'm not saying... Dude, you're acting like this is like a government-sanctioned thing that's going to happen.
It could be.
Let's
analog signals.
That's right. Barack Obama's going to say, look, in order to be more green, we're going to stop on the overhead production of packaging on all of these things. If you would like one of these...
I mean, it's just there is some logistical error...
I absolutely understand. I'm not cool with it. I don't
mean, anybody that's ever had a hard drive go tits up on them is going to, you know, freak.
Of course.
You want to... It's good to have, you know, MP3s or
it's
AVIs.
It's good to have on-demand access for things like
right.
If you want
it.
But
you want your hard copy. It's like your medical records. You still want them to be somewhere in a fucking file cabinet. You know, just so it's like
Jaws is like your medical.
It's like
records.
In Rollerball.
Mm-hmm.
With Jimmy Caan.
Mm-hmm.
And Moon Pie. When he goes to the library or whatever the
hell
it is.
Yeah, the giant weird computer
and
thing.
They lost the 14th century or some shit. It was just gone.
So it goes, yeah. No, I mean, that's why, I don't know, Blu-ray.
No, what it is, it'll still be, it's just a matter of there'll be more information on whatever technology the discs might change or whatever, or maybe.
There already is a lot, like a DVD is like... 4, maybe 5 gigs. It's like 4.5 gigs. Yeah, and a Blu-ray is like 50. So you're already talking about a pretty immense amount of data now being placed onto a disc.
Well, it depends on how many layers are on that disc.
Yeah, that's true, too. But,
and
I mean, you're right. They can always sort of improve to a point and, you know, get better and better and get different,
point,
a 4K projector and everything. But I think you're talking about like what's like worthwhile for a consumer level and consumer price range, and right now is the age when the Blu-ray
stuff
is there.
Well, look how long DVDs have been around. They've really only been around
about 10 years.
Yeah, 10 years, 15.
Let's say 99. I got my first DVD player in 99.
I got.
It was in the December of 99, so not
I
quite.
I guess I didn't buy my first DVD player until 2004, I guess. otherwise that is used.
But here's the other thing about it too. No one's going to take your DVDs away, your DVD player away. So
they might.
So you know, you upgrade to the next one, and it costs you some money, and then you buy all the new stuff.
They
that
take
way.
My license to drive,
and then and then you get new stuff with that, and it's better quality. And then the new one comes around, and you're like, "Fuck that! I got the new one already. I'm cool with Blu-ray."
What about
for 10
when
years.
Ayatollah takes over the United States?
Yeah, well, maybe that already happened.
And it becomes the United Khomeini.
Mm.
And they send out the
sounds like a collection of strippers that would come to your house for a hefty sum.
And they'd run off with your license to drive.
Uh-huh.
And whatever else, you know,
take your guns away from
them. No, they'd probably leave those because I'd be a warrior.
They'd take the bullets away.
Well, that's true. They'd take the bullets away and they'd give them back to you when the time was right.
Uh-huh.
But they definitely take away my Corp Feldman. My Corey.
They take the Coreys away.
They take the Coreys away.
You run on a platform of like just a liberation for the Coreys.
They're both still alive, right?
Of course they are for
they
now.
They still have a show?
I don't know. I think that show kind of ran aground.
I think it was still on when I still had cable.
Oh my gosh, yeah.
I have missed so much. It's been almost a year since it turned to put the blinders on.
Since you decided to become all Christian and stop watching the evil idiot box, right?
Yeah, it was cutting into my internet pornography time.
Oh man, victims aren't we all?
Wow. Obama's gonna make it right though. We're gonna endeavor to persevere.
Okay.
Yeah. Which reminds me, if we go back to. We haven't done any Clint Eastwood Westerns yet, have we?
No. I want to do Pale Rider because I've never seen it. And it's like the last one he did before Unforgiven. And right. I could stand to do Unforgiven again. But
well,
I'd have to be in the
Pale
right
Rider, mood. If we're doing Pale Rider, we should really start with Outlaw Josie Wales.
Okay, that'd be fine. I've never seen that, and I should just hammer those out.
You've never seen the Outlaw Josie Wales?
I'm not a huge Western fan, and the only time they would ever be on is like on AMC on full screen all the time, and I just don't want to watch it that way, you know?
Well, we're going to do that then.
Okay.
In fact, Clint Eastwood's own words, it's his favorite of his Westerns.
He likes it even better than the big Academy Award winning praiseful Unforgiven. Cool.
Yep.
Well, I will definitely want to check
it. He directed it also.
He directed The Rookie, too, which Seth and I watched today.
Well, you know.
Why do you roll your eyes? Have you seen that movie?
I've seen enough.
He's smoking a cigar, like, the entire time. Well,
I wonder what was up
with
that.
It's so
like,
close to
Heartbreak Ridge?
It's so close to a Callahan movie. I don't know. It's so annoying that, like, I haven't watched Tightrope yet, but that's another one where he's a cop in the 80s. And I'm like, I'm obsessed with all these Clint Eastwood cop movies.
Was that the one where it's in New Orleans?
I don't know, but it's got Carla's ex-husband in it. It's got Dan Hedaya, you know, the guy that was going to take over in Commando. I'm going to watch all these Clint Eastwood movies that are non-Westerns and just try to figure out, like...
You mean before he was in My Big Fat Greek Wedding?
Clint Eastwood wasn't in that movie.
No, Dan Hedaya.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Before Dan Hedaya was in that, yeah.
And I think he was in Mr. Wonderful.
I don't know. They sound like movies Nicole made you watch.
With Matt Dillon and Annabelle Ashore.
Did Nicole make you watch these movies, Matt?
No, they were just, you know, around when I was a kid. So okay. I watched them for the brain damage.
For sure. The Big Fat Greek Wedding is that old of a movie. I saw that movie with my mom and my grandma at the theater.
No, that one was Nicole. The Mr. Wonderful, I think. It was just around on VHS, so I watched it.
But, No, I'm trying to find that sixth Callahan movie. I'm like there are pieces
there
of
aren't
it.
Gonna be any more
there are pieces of it. Pieces of it in The Rookie, and they're like, and I'm just like, why couldn't this? I mean, I want to make up a story where it's like he's using his middle name and his mother's maiden name, and he's on special
Bridges
assignment.
Madison County.
And no, that was based on like a true story or some bullshit with a.
That was a book.
It's a book that's maybe, I don't know, some National Geographic photographer, and I don't know. That sounds lame, but like those handful of Clint Eastwood movies in the '80s and in the maybe even the early '90s.
So you need to watch Heartbreak Ridge.
That one's like he's a military guy. It's sort of different. Those are more... I'll watch like Firefox or whatever it's called. And I want to watch that one, the Iger Sanction. That's the one with the albino guy.
Oh, right, right. Tell me about
that. And he's like a... And then I want to watch Thunderbolt and Lightfoot because it's him and Jeff Bridges and they're like bank robbers or something. There's something zany. All those... In that period of the 70s and 80s, like, that are the non-Callahan, non-Western Clint Eastwood movies, most of them pretty cool. Now, Seth said Heartbreak Ridge was stupid, and I saw parts of it, and it was just, I didn't care. I don't care about that. I don't care about, what is it?
It's, yeah, in The Line of Fire, but that was 90s.
Yeah, In Line of Fire was okay. I liked In Line of Fire.
John Malkovich was...
That movie's a John solid... Malkovich. That movie's a solid movie.
It is a solid movie. It has a couple, it definitely has a lot of cliches, but John Malkovich is such a, I mean, he's just such a good bad guy that it keeps the movie going.
For sure. So, yeah.